Sai Ram Vivek, I am dying to get started. Can we?
Why not? Sure, go right ahead and ask what you want to ask.
Thanks a lot. Before we broke off this morning, we were talking about three types of genes associated with the three major constituents of a human being. You said that while the gross body came from the biological genes and the divine spark has its origins in the divine genes that came directly from God, the mind came from something you called vasanas. That was where we had to stop, and I would like to pick up from there. One thing you said was rather intriguing. You remarked that while the bio genes came from the parents and ancestors, and while the divine genes came from God, the vasanas or mental genes came from us.
That's right, Varun. I did say something to that effect.
Okay then, we agree thus far. But this is exactly where I have a problem.
Problem? What is that?
Listen, gene is a sort of a micro, a seed if you will, from which something macro emerges. If you say vasanas form the mental genes and come from us, I wonder how it could have existed before we were born. I mean, you can't have something called genes taking shape after birth, can you? It must in some way pre-exist birth and have a source. My problem is, where were my so-called vasanas before I was born? You see my point?
Yeah, I completely understand your difficulty. And in fact, the point you make is actually a very good one.
Okay, in that case, go ahead and answer my question.
Sure. You see, Varun, we are all so much focused on the body which we now have that we forget something very important.
Which is?
Which is that we have been here before many times.
Sorry, I don't read you.
Okay. Do you mind if I quote a poem by the famous Sufi poet Rumi?
I certainly do not. If it would help me understand you better, then certainly.
Very well then. Here is what Rumi said in part. I died a mineral and became a plant. I died a plant and rose as an animal. I died an animal and was man. And so on it goes. What this poet is trying to say is that each of us goes through many lives, some of the earlier ones being associated with lower forms, that is to say, as animals of various kinds.
Sorry to disappoint you, but I'm still not able to read you.
That is because I have not finished yet. Let me now offer you a quote from Swami, who says pretty much the same thing, but adds something more, which is very important and actually central to our discussion.
Okay, what is that?
Swami says, just as minerals became trees, the trees give rise to animate life. Lower animals then evolved into man. Evolution does not stop there. Man, having been blessed with the human form, must evolve further and become God.
But what has all this got to do with what you refer to as mental genes?
I am coming precisely to that. You see, my dear friend, right now you and I, each of us, has a body that is unique to us as individuals and seems very real to us. In an empirical sense, it sure is. But what we must not forget are two important facts related to this body we now possess.
Two important facts? What are they?
Firstly, aspects of this body have come from bodies that have existed earlier, and that fact has a great bearing on our current personality. Secondly, and this is very important, having been blessed with a human body presently, we must use this life to move continuously forward to become more and more godly.
Boy, you're sure making my head spin. Can you explain all that slowly, please, so that I can understand?
Of course, Varun. The famous physicist Steven Weinberg once said, the more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it also seems pointless. Now tell me, Varun, you are a techie. Do you believe this? I mean, do you believe that life has no deeper meaning and purpose? If God exists, and I presume you believe so, I mean, do you really think that God created this beautiful universe and put us all in it with absolutely no purpose whatsoever?
Look, you're asking a rather unfair question. Here I am, an absolute rookie to spirituality. What do you mean by bowling a nasty bouncer like that?
Varun, I'm not trying to browbeat you or put you down. All I'm doing is to ask a fundamental question. And that happens to be extremely crucial, Varun, at this point of human history.
In what way is your question so important? First, please explain that to me.
Sure. You agree, don't you, that humans have unleashed the forces of science and technology currently to an unimaginable extent?
Of course. And what are you complaining about? Can you not see the huge gains made and the tremendous good that has come out of it?
Did I deny that? I don't, Varun. You know that. But at the same time, do you not agree that he who unleashes the power of science and technology must also be humble and use this tremendous power he commands for common good rather than for advancing selfish or limited interests?
Look, frankly, I do not know what you're talking about. We just agreed a moment ago that science and technology have done so much good. I mean, just look at the world of medicine. Can you not see how many millions of lives are being saved by science and technology?
I entirely agree, Varun. I completely concur with that view. But at the same time, don't you agree that there is also a lot of misuse of science and technology that is going on now?
Yes, there is, but you cannot blame it entirely on scientists and technologists alone. Plenty of others are also involved.
I agree with that. But what happens when brilliant scientists like Weinberg start saying that life has no purpose and stuff like that?
Look, why are you bothered about what he says? Let him say whatever he wants. Who cares?
No, Varun. Things are not as simple as you make it. Great achievers also become role models to many, especially for those who wish to emulate them. If thousands of young men and women who want to become great scientists start thinking in this manner and believe that life has no purpose, then not only would life become totally rudderless for them, they would even be prepared to sell their talents without any consideration to the consequences.
I do not follow what you're saying.
Okay, let me give you an important example. I'm sure you know about the atom bomb.
Are you kidding? Who does not?
Okay, so you must have also heard about the hydrogen bomb, right?
Yes, I have. A hydrogen bomb actually requires an atom bomb to get triggered or fired.
Now, people already knew from Hiroshima and Nagasaki that the atom bomb itself was deadly. Why on earth did they then go about inventing the hydrogen bomb, which could be anywhere from 10 to 100 times more devastating than the Hiroshima type of bomb?
I was not born then, but I heard it was all due to the so-called Cold War.
You are right. World War II ended in 1945. However, almost immediately began the famous Cold War between the erstwhile Soviet Union and the Western powers. And it lasted till the Soviet Union finally collapsed literally overnight around 1990. Mind you, during the Cold War, there was actually no real fighting between the two superpowers. But there was plenty of tension. And it was as a result of this tension that both the powers went for the hydrogen bomb.
All right, you have told me a bit of history. But what has all this got to do with the point we are supposed to be discussing?
I am coming precisely to that. With the Cold War becoming intense, the military in America lobbied hard for the hydrogen bomb. And sure enough, its development was soon authorized. However, the very first design, while it did prove the concept, was big, uncouth, and too clumsy for tactical military use. Somehow, the bomb design had to be significantly improved to make the hydrogen bomb both small and efficient.
So, what happened then?
Well, the human brain being fertile, many bright young scientists came forward with ingenious concepts for making the hydrogen bomb compact. Thus, a vigorous thrust was made in developing what might be called a new and improved design.
That sounds very much like a toothpaste or soap ad.
That was the way the military and the hawks sold the development idea to the government.
Okay, so what did the government do then?
They formed a new young team led by an absolutely brilliant theoretical physicist from UK named Freeman Dyson to do the development. And Dyson came up with the clever idea of radiation heating of the hydrogen bomb fuel. In a nutshell, that made the fearsome hydrogen bomb very compact. I mean, a bomb 50 times as powerful as the Hiroshima bomb could be made as small as, say, a small bucket. And in the nose cone of an intercontinental ballistic missile could be placed 4 to 5 such hydrogen bombs, each aimed at a different target.
Sounds pretty nightmarish, no doubt. But why are you telling me all this? Have we not drifted somewhat from what we were discussing earlier?
There is a specific point I wish to make, Varun. You see, years after all this happened, Dyson was once interviewed about his work. And he was asked, "Don't you think you harmed the cause of world peace by working on such deadly weapons? What made you do so?"
And what was Dyson's reply?
He admitted that he was morally wrong in having used his brains to design weapons that were far more deadly than those that were designed before.
Being a very intelligent man, Dyson surely must have known what he was getting into, right? Surely there must have been at that time plenty of people strongly opposed to nuclear weapons, and yet he got involved in such work. Why?
That really is the key question, is it not? By the way, soon after the war, many physicists who earlier worked on the famous Manhattan Project in America, where the first atom bomb was developed, felt a deep moral objection to nuclear weapons, and they quit weapons work, even though there were plenty of job opportunities. They all went back to universities to become teachers and professors. Moreover, even Albert Einstein and Bertrand Russell led a strong global anti-nuclear weapons movement in the 50s till they passed away. So it was not as if all the scientists got seduced, shall I say, by the glamour of developing bigger and better weapons.
So it all comes back, does it not, to the question why such a brilliant man like Dyson, a giant in his field, so to say, became involved in such a dreadful activity.
Actually, Dyson himself gave the explanation later. He said, "It all happened because we literally sold our souls to the devil."
You mean he was attracted by the scientific challenges and the excitement the work offered?
That's right, Varun. You see, for many great scientists, problems and challenges are like magnets. They easily get attracted by puzzles, by unsolved problems and intriguing questions because these challenge them and they bring out the best of their originality, creativity and so on.
But what about the consequences of what they are doing? How can intelligent people be indifferent to that?
Yeah, that's exactly where spirituality begins to tangle with so-called daily and ordinary life, my friend. By the way, for the record, I should mention that at the time of the Vietnam War, which was fought between the late 60s and early 70s, the defense establishment in America poured money into the development of all kinds of deadly but conventional weapons, and a lot of this research took place on university campuses. Many professors went for it, because it meant cushy research grants. However, there were also professors who swore by their conscience and refused to touch such money, even though it meant a lot of hardship for them in many ways. They even had to bear a lot of insults, being called unpatriotic and all that, but they remained steadfast to their ideals.
Ideals? Which were?
Their point was simple, Varun. They said, students come to a university to learn. Their duty as teachers was to shape the minds of students in such a way that they acquired knowledge and later used it for purposes that were beneficial to society, and not to wage war or find efficient ways of destroying fields and farms or kill people in large numbers and so on.
I think you have made an important point, and I really need to let this sink in for a while before responding. Meanwhile, anything more you have to add?
Yes, just one thing, Varun. And after that, we can swing back all the way and link what we are talking about now to what we were discussing earlier.
And what is this other thing that you want to mention?
Professor Victor. I want to draw attention to an important remark that Professor Victor Weisskopf of MIT once made. He made this during an address he gave before the American Association for the Advancement of Science.
What was it that this Professor Weisskopf said?
Before I quote what he said, I should perhaps mention that this professor came from Austria in the 30s. He was a Jew and he sought to escape from Hitler's long arm. He came to the US and during the war, he worked on the atom bomb project. After the war, he became a full-time academic and he stayed away from military research.
I see. I'm anxious to hear the quote of Professor Weisskopf.
Yeah, I'm coming to that. This professor said, and I quote, "Knowledge without compassion is inhuman, while compassion without knowledge is ineffective," unquote. I should add that by knowledge, the learned professor meant scientific and technological knowledge.
That is an interesting and a profound remark too. I sort of understand the first part. Basically, it is a strong warning not to misuse scientific knowledge, right?
Correct. And that was the sort of thing Dyson admitted he did, misled by false values, ideas, and of course the dubious excitement that the project offered.
But Vivek, what does the professor mean by saying compassion without knowledge is ineffective? I do not quite follow that.
That actually is an important point. Let me give the example of what often happens in villages. As you know, snake bites are quite common in most of our villages, especially the small and remote ones. The proper thing to do is to immediately take the victim to the nearest hospital. However, being ignorant, most villagers take the victim to some kind of a tantric who is often a witch doctor kind of a fellow, you know.
So, what you're saying is that their sense of compassion makes these poor and ignorant villagers want to help, but lack of scientific knowledge makes them do the wrong thing, right?
That's exactly right, Varun.
You know, we have wandered quite a bit, and I would like to pause and sort of take stock of what we have discussed thus far.
That's a really good idea. If you recall, it all started with the three basic entities a human being is made up of: the gross body, the subtle mind, and the atma.
And after that, you identified three kinds of genes associated with these three components. These were the biological genes that were associated with the physical body, the vasanas associated with the mind, and finally the divine gene that can be linked to the atmic aspect within us.
Great job, Varun. That was a crisp and correct recall of what we have discussed.
Thanks. And after you brought up the vasanas, somehow we seem to have wandered off into hydrogen bombs and that kind of stuff. Take me back to the vasanas and link it up to the mind, please.
Sure, Varun. And by the way, this is a very important link. As I told you, according to Vedanta, a human being takes birth after death. And when he or she does so, the person brings into the new birth behavioral tendencies acquired in the earlier birth.
I'm sorry, Vivek, but I need some more elaboration.
Yes, I will explain to you how this vasana thing works. See, let us say there is a person who is prone to being rather short-tempered. That person dies eventually and is born again. In this new birth, the body might be different, but the behavioral tendency of the quote-unquote new person would be based on what the person was like in the earlier birth.
You mean this person would have a strong tendency to get angry at the drop of a hat?
Yes. This person would have an inborn tendency, shall I say, to blow his fuse rather easily.
So the vasana gets passed on from birth to birth like a baton is during a relay race. Is that what you're trying to say?
Yeah, something like that.
But what if the person says, "I don't like this short temper. I shall do all it takes to get rid of it." In that case, in the next birth, the person would not have this excess baggage, right?
You are absolutely right, Varun. Realizing his deficiency, the person in this case makes a strong effort to refine himself or herself, as the case may be.
I guess you would now say that all this is related to something you mentioned earlier, namely that having been blessed with a human body presently, we must use this life to move continuously forward to becoming more and more godly.
Exactly. So you see, Varun, seen from this perspective, the universe is not without a purpose, as Steven Weinberg says or feels.
Can you please tie up the various bits we have gone through so far so that I can get an integrated picture of all that we have been discussing in this session?
Sure. Let us start with Weinberg's remarks that though we are able to understand quite a lot of the physics of the universe, yet it seems to exist without a purpose. That is because Weinberg probably does not believe that there is a God who created this universe or willed its existence, if you want it that way.
So are you saying that the purpose of the universe can be understood only when we bring God into the picture?
Absolutely. I mean, God is the creator, and all of us, including you and me, form a part of this creation. Whether we like it or not, there is an intimate relationship between the creator and the creation. Unless we understand that, we cannot see any purpose in this universe.
Okay, I agree that there is a creator behind creation. But then, why did God create this universe?
That is a good question. And there are various ways of answering that question. I shall probably follow one particular line that is appropriate for our present discussion.
Which is?
I would say the universe was created as a platform or a stage for a divine play. And for this divine drama, the stars, the galaxies, the planets all form something like a stage. God now allows life to emerge, and then the various species start evolving.
So, we have life going through all forms, from the very primitive molecule with attributes called life, whatever it is, to primates, right?
Correct. And then humans appear. And that is where the drama takes an interesting turn.
In what way?
You see, Varun, a bee, a frog, a parrot or a tiger, etc., all these living species know they exist. I mean, they are aware of their existence and are able in some manner to relate it to the world around them.
So what you're saying is that every living species is capable of the awareness that it exists and relates this awareness about self-existence to the external world.
Indeed. That is why when you try to, say, swat a fly, it becomes aware of a threat to it and flies away immediately. Why? Because it wants to protect itself. It wants to survive.
And this, I suppose, is achieved via the senses and the brain working together.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I believe we went through all that earlier.
Okay. In what way is a human being who, according to current understanding, was the last one to emerge in this long chain of evolution of species, in what way is a human being special? Clearly, there are many things special about a human being that I can understand. But from a spiritual point of view, is there anything extra and unique?
Indeed. And that really is the hub of the entire discussion we are having.
Oh, you know what? I'm looking at my watch now. And I know what you're going to say next. Let's take a break and do it all in the next session, right?
Yeah, you indeed are.